Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson. Welcome again to Democratic Perspective. Sitting across from me is my beloved co-host.
Yes, right here. Mike Cosentino here. We got Peg Bowden in the studio this morning.
And we've got our producer and writer, Gary LeMaster.
Can't forget Silent Gary. our research crew.
So Peg Bowden has written a book called A Land of Hard Edges. It was published, I think, June of this of 2014. Correct. She lives on the border between the United States and Mexico, and her stories and her tales and her information is from real physical presence on the border.
One of the things we like at Democratic Perspective is to, Steve, Peg, Gary, has there been more crap written and said about the Arizona-Mexico border than any other region in the world? We're talking about out-and-out lies. We're talking about exaggerations. Hopefully we're going to at least take a few steps toward a little more reality, I guess, today is what we're after.
I think, yes. I think we want to be theoretical, but I think we really want to talk about your experience on the border. You lived in Ashland, Oregon most of your life. You're a retired nurse. You moved to the border. You're originally from Tucson. You moved to the border because you wanted to get back to Arizona. Yeah, you apparently wanted to come to a land with hard edges and sticky plants.
Right. And it is a land of hard edges. You know, after living in Oregon for 30 years, everything's soft in Oregon. You know, you sink into the ground.
Soaked.
Yes, soft and soaked, and you kind of sink in an inch when you're walking in the forest. And there's moss. You can touch plants, and there's a velvety texture to the leaves. I guess what I noticed in moving back to the desert, which for me is a real sacred place, but everything's hard. The ground is hard. Climbing a hill, I will usually bruise my knees or my rear end. I will come back to my house with bloody hands because I, you know, pulled on a branch trying to scramble up a hill. And also, often the people have lived really hard lives. So, for me, this is a land of hard edges.
Yeah. Where do you live now on the border?
I live, in a very remote area east of Tumacacori, which is one of the Kino missions there. And, I can see the lights of Nogales from our ranch. We have 50 acres. We, built a rammed earth home. We live on a canyon. And, it takes me about a half hour to really get to the border, but as the crow flies, we're maybe 6 miles from Mexico.
And there is a separate culture, isn't there, or at least there used to be, along the border, a border culture where people went back and forth. I know from talking to many people who were raised on the border that it was that the line between Mexico and the United States was not so fixed.
Well, growing up in Tucson in the 50s and the 60s, you know, my family used to take the Minnesota, Iowa relatives when they come to visit down to Mexico to get their Kahlua and their rum and their tequila. And, my brother's Charles Bowden, who's an incredibly iconic author in Arizona who recently died. But Chucky and I would storm ahead from our parents when we were in Nogales and just slide under this rusty, barbed wire fence. There was one strand, I remember, and be in Mexico and our parents would stay in line. But I remember the gate being kind of like an old garden gate, really, that the customs people would open for you when entering Mexico. They would say, welcome, bienvenidos. There was no identification necessary. Of course, as kids, we didn't have any ID. And It was a fascinating, exotic place to be. I felt perfectly safe. You know, the vendors in Mexico would see my mother coming, of course, because she always bought purses and all the stuff, silver for all the relatives back in the Midwest. And we'd have dinner at Elvira's, which was a restaurant that was in Nogales. And then we'd come home. And there was no wall. There was no border patrol back then. And I loved it. It was a land of two languages. Everybody spoke Spanish and English. The food was different. If you went to the supermarket, there were 13 different kinds of chili peppers. they sold corn husks there for tamales. It was a rich, ethnically, culturally, a very rich place to grow up as a kid.
Right on the border between two cultures, right?
Yes. Santa Cruz County, which is where I live, is 85% Latino. So the music on the radio is Mexican stations. Everybody speaks Spanish. It is like having one foot in Mexico and one foot in the U.S.
But then we fast forward into you writing this book.
Right.
A Land of Hard Edges. And it's a different time and place, and certainly a different attitude and different everything.
It's a different world. Yeah, we moved back in 2002. I was a little worried because all I knew was what I read in the newspapers, which was banditos will assault you in the desert. And we live in a very remote place. I mean, we don't have cell phone reception. We do get computer and ground line, but we're out there. So I was worried about drug smugglers coming across our land, the violence I read about. And I noticed in 2003 and 4 when I would drive to the grocery store, which takes me a half hour to get to the grocery store, often there would be lines of 5 or 6 or 7 young men sitting on the side of this country road in dark hoodies with like a gallon jug of water beside them. Border Patrol agent would be pacing back and forth. Everybody looked glum and depressed, including the Border Patrol agent.
Yeah.
The men would give me eye contact. I would look at them. They would look at me. Some of them would give me the peace sign. Once or twice I stopped and asked the Border Patrol agent, hey, you need any water? And he would say, no, we're fine, ma'am, we're fine. Just keep driving, lady. And, I think to myself, okay, Peg, just mind your own business. Homeland Security knows what they're doing. But I would think to myself, okay, are these the terrorists? Are these the bandits? Are these the drug smugglers? Because to me, they just look like lost boys in a lost land.
And I'm sure very often they were.
Yeah.
I was stopped by the Border Patrol once in my life. We had a big old Grand Prix in the day. We were driving along the Texas-Mexico border, and we were going over the speed limit, but it was Texas, and so it didn't seem to matter because, that's where my family's from, and partially. And it wasn't the police. It was the Border Patrol. And we had all our camping equipment and stuff, and they pulled up next to us. They took one look at us and said, oh, blank. And didn't say one more word and got up in their vehicle and drove off.
Mm.
But it wasn't the kind of, isn't there a much more, I know that people in the Green Valley and stuff are concerned about kind of an oppressive feeling. I mean, the Border Patrol was there, but they weren't this looming presence over everything
right.
in those days.
Well, it's a looming presence now. I mean, 20 miles from the border, there's a border checkpoint. So not only if you're crossing from Mexico in the U.S., you go through that bit of security. And I mean, the people from Immigration Customs, ICE, and Border Patrol agents, they've got their weapons slung over their shoulder. I mean, you pass through that gauntlet, and then 20 miles up the road, there's yet another checkpoint, more Border Patrol agents with dogs sniffing your car. It feels like we're at war. But we're not.
let's talk about the people.
Yeah.
First of all, why? What prompted the book?
What prompted the book was I'm living it every day. I'm living these young men by the side of the road. I'm living men with guns parading in front of me, asking me to roll down my window at the checkpoint, asking me if I'm a U.S. citizen. One story I have to tell you. I play in a band. I play the timpani. I play in orchestras, too. And so I had a timpani in my back seat because I was going on my way to a concert. And
it's a great big drum, right?
It is a big copper kettle drum.
Thank you.
And so the agent had never seen one or something, so he stopped me and asked me to pop my trunk because he wanted to look. I said, well, why? And he said, well, what is that in the back seat? And I said, oh, okay, I'm a musician, and actually I'm late. I need to get to a concert, and that's my drum, that's my timpani. And he said, well, I need to have a look. And I said, well, what do you think's in there, drugs? And, you know, wrong thing to say. So I did pop the trunk, and he tapped it a little bit. And then he came back. He said, oh, I remember in high school, you know, seeing those instruments on the stage. And okay, of course, he let me go, and he didn't tear open the skin of the drum to see what was in it. But, you know, that kind of questioning happens to people every day.
And you wanted to tell a story.
And as far as why I wrote the book, I guess what, well, first of all, for years, I was haunted by those men by the side of the road. I was haunted by all those Border Patrol trucks up and down the freeway. I was bugged by the checkpoint, but I did nothing. And I think it was 2011, the Gabrielle Giffords shooting in a Safeway parking lot in Tucson, 19 people shot. That woke me up from my quiet, safe little retired life out on my remote ranch. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to live here, I've got to get more involved in something that's been bugging my conscience now for 6, 7, 8 years. And so quite by accident, I found out about the Samaritans, the Green Valley Samaritans. I showed up at a meeting. I began going down to Mexico and volunteering in a shelter. And I committed to do this for 1 year because I just wanted to learn about what was going on the border, immerse myself in it. And, of course, now I'm going on 4 years that I've been doing this. But as I began listening to the migrants, or refugees, actually, because that's what they are, as I began listening to their stories, I started emailing my kids. They said, Mom, you got to write about this. I started a blog, and then from that, I decided to write a book. So that's what prompted me.
Let's talk a little bit about terminology. We had a little discussion before we went on the air about the vocabulary, the illegal term, and I. You know, even the illegals I know here call themselves illegals.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is. And we have migrant, and we have undocumented, and now we like, at least the people in this room, kind of like the term refugee. They're economic refugees in mm-hmm. some cases, in most cases, I suppose, and somewhat the. Political refugees, in a way, if you consider the violence and the cartels,
they're refugees in every sense, except the formal definition, I think, used by the U.S. government,
right.
Is that you have to be persecuted by a government or a regime,
and often are actually we created them, and you know the our involvement in the war in El Salvador and Nicaragua during the 80s. Basically helped support and create death squads.
We overthrew the Honduran government.
So
right?
We ramped up the violence dramatically. The refugees from that came to the U.S. The El Salvadorans ended up being set upon by the violent gangs in the U.S., created their own gang, MS-13, which became the most violent gang, but they did it as a defense mechanism. They were thrown in prison, made even more violent, and then deported, and so they recruited more people in their home countries, mm-hmm. and those people come back, and so they are forcing people in those countries to join their gangs and be involved in the war. So this is a mess of our own creating.
Exactly.
And then to make matters worse, we passed NAFTA, and our agribusinesses, ADM and Cargill and Continental Grain, started dumping massive amounts of corn at subsidized prices into these countries, mm-hmm. which is their main staple food. And we drove their small farmers out of business. And so now they're looking for a place to a way to make a living.
And when you drive a rural, you know, I mean, this is, I don't care what country you're in, you could be on either side of the border, put it that way. When you drive a farmer out of business, it's not like he has a lot of things to fall back on.
I mean, he has to go somewhere.
There is desperation there. There is pure desperation there.
And most of the people I meet at the Comedor, which means dining area, which is a shelter where I volunteer, are indigenous peasant farmers from southern Mexico and from Central America. And I've asked them, why didn't you just go to work for NAFTA? You know, when NAFTA came in, and they said, well, first of all, you've got big machines doing the work on our farms. Secondly, you've ruined our soil with your chemicals and your pesticides. And thirdly, we were growing different kinds of corn and crops in Mexico. My family's been doing this for hundreds of years. And with your GMO crops, the genetically modified food and seeds, you've contaminated the kind of corn that we've been growing. And then, of course, your corn is subsidized. You're selling it cheaper than we ever could. There is no way we can survive anymore on our farm. So that's why we're here. And we don't want to work in your factories, because I'm not a factory worker. I'm a farmer, and I'm on my way to Oregon or Washington or South Carolina or wherever to work in your fields and pick your strawberries and your peaches. One guy said, you know, when you put strawberries on your cereal this morning, you think about me.
And you work in it. It's a Jesuit facility.
Yes.
Talk about the facility. Talk about the work, please.
So I go down to Mexico every Tuesday morning with a group, six or seven of us, from the Samaritans. I call them renegade senior citizens. They're all children of the 60s, I think. You know, they all have white hair. And we go to this shelter, which is really a dugout piece of hillside. The walls of the shelter are dirt. It is a simple, humble place. The shelter feeds between 50 to 100 to 150 meals twice a day to traveling pilgrims or refugees who are either on their way north or they've been lost in our desert and are there to just recuperate. And the place looks a little like Bethlehem, the stable at Bethlehem. It is simple, rough. There's a couple of cats running around catching the resident mice, I'm sure. There's a small kitchen. The walls, as I said, are dirt. There's a tarp in the front. It's cold in the winter there. It is hot in the summer there. And yet, it is a saving place for many, many people.
Located again in relation to Nogales.
It is in Nogales. It's off of the Mariposa exit, which is the agricultural kind of exit. We park on the U.S. side and we walk about a mile to get to the shelter. So it's about a half a mile from the border.
So
why do you park
on
the U.S. side?
Well, the lines of cars coming, getting in is no problem, but coming back, there's usually quite a line. And actually, the walk is very pleasant. You're walking on the U.S. side. You see our militarized, Homeland Security pacing back and forth, not allowing you to take any pictures. The moment, I mean, the second you cross the border, there are the street vendors, the newspaper vendors, Mexican customs, people saying, bienvenidos, welcome. Do you want to use our flush toilet before you get to the shelter? There is this feeling of welcome. Do you have any socks? Some of them ask, because we're always, we carry socks and underwear and various clothes. And there's this warmth just the minute you cross into Mexico. And I think that's one reason I do it. I do it for a lot of reasons, but I love the graciousness and the generosity of the Mexican people.
You set your book up with seasons.
I did, yes.
And I can imagine that, at least as far as border crossing, one season is probably better than another.
Yeah.
But also, I got the sense that you set it up because of the events and the cultural impact of each season.
Right. Yes, I thought a lot about how I was going to set up the book, and the different seasons bring different problems. Actually, this is a good time to cross right now because the weather isn't so extreme. I mean, in the winter, people freeze in the desert, literally. In the summer, people bake, and they die in our desert. But also, I guess I set it up that way because I don't think most people in this country appreciate the beauty of the desert during the different times of year, the bird migration, the blossoms, the animals that come out in the spring, the fact that the flowers are just incredible. And so I describe each season as best I can. And also, you know, there's different festivals in Mexico that I've become very involved in because I'm down there every week. There's Dia de los Muertos in November, late October. There's the La Posada, which is the Christmas parade, really, through Nogales, which we do with the migrants, which is very moving. And the summer is, of course, the deadliest time to cross. And yet, you know, people from Honduras and Guatemala don't realize really how deadly our desert is. So we do a lot of teaching about what to expect when they cross the desert. And we try and dissuade people, to be perfectly honest, because it takes a minimum of 5 to 7 days to walk from Nogales to Tucson. And you are dodging helicopters, border patrol agents, the rough terrain, the weather, the hard edges.
Yeah.
And but people make it. It amazes me. People make it.
Mike said one time, we were doing another interview about immigration and about the border, and he said, why don't Americans respond to this refugee crisis with compassion? Why is it all these violent, hateful, paranoid, fearful responses to what seem 99% of the people seem like just very, very nice folks who are just trying to get by like all the rest of us.
And we have the means to evaluate. It's not like we have to take it all on faith like we used to. There's ways of knowing. I have to admit, I'm going to expand on that a little bit. I don't understand why all the anger? Why all the fear?
Of children, Mike.
It's fear of children. I can answer that. It's good politics.
Okay, that's a good answer.
That's why it divides people and it creates passions and it turns people out to vote. It's good politics.
And if you ask the people who are responding, and I'm talking about, you know, I got emails from conservative relatives back east that felt sorry for me and wanted to know that, you know, I went down to Bisbee and whatnot and how terrible it was on the border. What was it like? And I'm saying, I don't know, quite understand the fear, but I'm talking, these are people that supposedly aren't political people. They don't pay attention to politics.
You mean the family values people that don't care for families.
My guy's down at the coffee shop. My guy's, I don't understand that. I don't understand I'm a family of immigrants. You know, I'm second generation. I mean, these people that came over from, and they had it rough in some cases, but it wasn't necessarily because
there's
they were
a history of fear of immigrants in the United States. And yet they didn't like the Scotch-Irish. The English didn't like the Scotch-Irish, and the Scotch-Irish and the English didn't like the Germans and the Italians and the Jews and the Eastern Europeans and then the Puerto Ricans. So there's this fear of people that don't look like you
and
don't sound like you.
Right. And we have a history of isolating and persecuting people of color. We have a history. Of course, I grew up in the 60s. I saw the segregation of schools and the racism involved in that, which we're still struggling with. You know, we've isolated American Indians on reservations. And, you know, when I was driving by those groups of men by the side of the road with the Border Patrol agent, I couldn't help but think of the Germans rounding up the Jews, or the Nazi Germans anyway, rounding up the Jews, putting them in trucks, just like we were doing with these men I would see. And I know maybe the analogy doesn't hold totally, but I, you know, the people in Germany were driving to the grocery store just like I was and ignoring the situation.
Even if the analogy doesn't hold, it was it sounds like it was deeply felt. It was very disturbing for you to see people being hauled off. You didn't know where or when, or maybe nothing horrible is going to happen to them, but still just seeing people, large numbers of people, day after day.
Exactly.
You said earlier that you had some German friends come to visit.
Yes.
And tell us their comments.
Well, people from all over the world come to the Commodore. It's, in fact, people from other countries. There are more people from other countries that come than Americans, journalists, photographers. So
I want to point out, by the way, that this is a vehicle of compassion.
Yes.
So we are, I mean, something has happened, at least the Kino Institute, which you're going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah.
I want to say real quickly, we're talking to Peg Bowden, author of A Land of Hard Edges, and we're talking about the border of Arizona and Mexico, and we're talking at the moment here about the facility that she serves at. She talks about the subtitle of her book is Serving the Front Lines of the Border. She and a bunch of others are serving on the front lines of the border, and she's going to tell us a little more about that right now.
Well, I've taken guests down from other countries. One was a German photographer, so we were walking toward Mexico, and so she got out her camera, started taking pictures on the U.S. side, and was stopped by Border Patrol agents. They said, this is a federal facility. It is a felony to do what you're doing. And they grabbed her camera and deleted the picture she had taken. And she was astounded. I mean, this woman has been to the West Bank, Gaza, the Gaza Strip, and witnessed the Palestine-Israel conflicts. She said, this is like East Germany. This is worse than East Germany. She had never been treated quite so abruptly.
When was this pic?
This was less than a year ago.
Wow.
This is less than a year ago.
And it's illegal to photograph anything on the border.
So, you know, when we were accosted, really, by this Border Patrol agent, which, by the way, was a woman, I said, well, you mean I can't take a picture of the U.S. Post Office? If that's a federal facility, which probably didn't help matters any. Because, you know, the whole story is we were detained for about an hour. Mm-hmm. And they went through our backpack. She went through my camera, my photographer friend's camera, before we could get into Mexico. So it was one of those moments I'll never forget, because I'm a citizen. I'm a U.S. citizen.
Well, and especially compared to your experiences as a girl on the border.
Right.
I mean, you know, the gentleman opening the gate and saying, you know,
welcome.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
One thing that I would encourage people to check out is there's an entity called Vice News, V-I-C-E, that has a program weekly on HBO, and so it's small documentaries. And they did a show on the refugees from Honduras and El Salvador, that wave that came last summer in particular, mothers and children. Mm-hmm. And I really encourage you, you can find it on the web, and I really encourage you to check it out, because it really shows the hardships that these people, why they're coming here, mm-hmm. and the hardships of what they're facing. And a lot of it coincides directly with what you're talking
about.
Well,
the other side of the politic, I mean, all this anger, all this violence, and all this hate seems to be politically driven. Hating on children and being afraid of.
Remember, there was the Republican congressional candidate who talked about the fear he saw in the eyes of these children who he thought were immigrant children who were actually YMCA kids going to camp.
That happened right outside of Tucson.
It's almost delusional, a hatred of people and fear of people and fearing children. I mean, it's astonishing.
We take refugees from all over the world. We're bound to do that by treaty. So we take it, you know, and Somalis and Ethiopians and people from war-torn areas throughout the world. And we take in thousands of them, and we bring them in and put them on Social Security, SSI insurance. And then we have these people that, as I mentioned earlier, we created these refugees, mm-hmm. and we treat them like criminals, and send them back to be beaten and shot by their own, you know, gangs in their own country.
Well, that's why the title of her book has so many levels, you know. I mean, she discussed earlier Land of Hard Edges and talking about the desert and its prickers and its stickers and its rocks and all the things that we've come to know and love. I'm looking at my arms because I was gardening the other day, and they just stopped bleeding. But and so that part of the title we get. But the other part of the title, I think, which is great, is the those hard edges, those political edges that just seem to be have no compassion, and yet beyond the politics, I guess we're talking about Peg Bowden's group today. So tell us a little more about this Kino, what's the name of it again?
The Kino Border Initiative.
Thank you.
KBI, yeah. They're the people, they're Jesuit priests who run the Comedor, the shelter, along with a group of nuns from Mexico called the Sisters of the Eucharist. Now, I am not Catholic, but I have great admiration for the Catholic Church and being front and center on this problem. These people do not mince words. They call it like it is. And I'd also like to say that the Green Valley Samaritans, my renegade group of senior citizens, are made up of atheists, agnostics, Buddhists, Jews, a few Catholics, a few Christians, and everything in between.
Just a normal American community.
The normal American community. But we all have the core belief that we're all in this together. We are all human beings. We need to be treated with respect, dignity, and if people are fleeing for their life, you help them. You give them water when they are thirsty. You give them food when they are hungry. If they are in the desert, you stop. It is a felony to stop and give aid to an undocumented migrant in our desert. It is a felony to put that person in your car and take him to a clinic or doctor. I thought a lot about if I am put in that position.
We've criminalized compassion.
We have criminalized compassion.
That's great.
Thank you.
That's good
exactly.
to know.
Yeah. So this is not right. This is not the America I love. This is not what my parents taught me. And yet we have laws saying we're aiding and abetting terrorists. Well, here's what I think. You know, the wall, which, for the record, is an abomination, and I am embarrassed and ashamed that it's there. The wall is not keeping out terrorists. The terrorists are flying into our country with papers from other countries, or the terrorists live here already. The people we're keeping out with that wall are poor people. The wall keeps out poor people, and that's my
firm belief. People of color.
And people of color. You're right.
Border issues have been talked about and exaggerated beyond the ability of this little program to settle it, but Peg Bowden as a guest this morning has four recommendations sitting in front of her. So what should we do about, what's your idea? What can we do about this?
Well, thank you. Yeah, this is if I were the fairy godmother of politics and could wave a magic wand, I have four things I would do. I guess the first thing is I would issue guest worker visas to peasant farmers and to low-skilled laborers who are from Mexico and Latin America. They want to come here. They want to work for 3, 4, 5 months. They want to pick the strawberries and peaches, work in our fields. Then they want to go back home. And they want to do this without being harassed by the authorities. That is a simple fix, it seems to me. Secondly, I would decriminalize drugs. The war on drugs is a joke. It is a total failure. It is a war for drugs, not against drugs. Drugs have never been cheaper, more plentiful, or easier to get than they are today. And we've been fighting this war now for 40 years. It's more than just say no, Nancy Reagan. It is, you know, I'm a nurse. I've taken care of a lot of people with addictions, particularly women and children. So I have some feelings about addiction. But criminalizing it is not the answer. It is a public health issue. And I think rather than throwing people in jail, we need to get them into treatment. And really, we don't know a lot about treatment. The treatment hasn't changed much in the last 20, 30 years. It's because we pour all our money into prisons and throwing people in jail. So if we decriminalize drugs, who knows? Maybe some of those drug cartel people would become upstanding businessmen, and it would be an incredible market for both, because the United States is the consumer of drugs. Mexico and Latin America are supplying the drugs.
So however it's done, you want to take the profit out of the drug trade.
I do, yeah.
I get it.
Exactly.
NAFTA is complicated, but let's talk about
number
that.
Number three, yeah. I would rethink NAFTA because we talked about it a bit before. 75% of immigration increased after 1994.
North American Free Trade Agreement.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton, it sounded like a good idea to me back in 94, but it's one of those things that's created a monster in that the indigenous farmers can no longer make it because of the subsidized crops and stuff we had poured into Mexico. So they've come north, and you know, this isn't a lark for the migrants. They are fleeing for economic reasons, and many of them are fleeing for their life because of the violence. So they are refugees. And we are not taking them in.
In some ways, people predicted NAFTA, I think, as a proof of the rule of unintended consequences.
Yeah,
you were a thinking person in 1994. You said, well, maybe just a little do stuff.
I was on the same page on that. Remember when we talked to Noam Chomsky? He said the ACLU had a... the unions had a proposal for NAFTA that would have protected American jobs and stuff. There was an alternative to it. Same idea, different ways of grounding it into law and agreement. And according to Chomsky, it was just totally ignored.
So I think it's
people just blew it off.
Is it fair to say that American business, corrupted what otherwise maybe been a workable plan?
I think it got distorted. Yeah, I think it sounded like a good idea, but it got distorted. Particularly the damage that Gary was mentioning earlier to some very small farmers in Mexico. Like, it was devastating. It's forced hundreds and thousands of people off their farm.
It just succumbed to the same stuff that almost every other law does, and that is, as soon as a law passes, you know, there was a lot of ridicule of the Affordable Care Act that was 2,000 pages. The reason for the bills having to be so long is as soon as a bill is proposed and starts making its way into law, large corporations have large corporate staffs of attorneys, and they start looking for every possible loophole. And that's what happened to NAFTA, is these large corporations, particularly agribusiness, saw all sorts of loopholes in this. And actually, they forced some of those loopholes into the bill. But it was a bill that was supported by five different presidents, not just Clinton, but by Carter, by Ford, by Reagan, and by
Bush 1. Look, it sounded good, Gary. It, at the time, I remember hearing it sounded good. More trade, factories on the other side of the border.
Yeah. It would help out their population.
Right. Yeah,
it
was well, supposed to increase, increase
to
immigration
win-win.
Because they would keep them home.
Right. Yeah. We were wrong. It was not a win-win. It was win-lose. And instead of free trade, I think it needs to be fair trade. Meaning equitable prices for goods. The people I meet, don't want to leave Mexico. They don't want to leave their homes. If they had their druthers, they would rather be back in their village with their mother's good home cooking and making a simple living. This is not, many are looking for the American dream, but most of the people I meet are not. They want to work here, but they want to return to their villages.
We only have a few minutes left. I want to make sure we get the fourth point.
Right. And
the first,
it's a good segue into your fourth point.
Number four, we have a lot of people here we call the dreamers, which are the young people that have been here since they were little kids. They're undocumented, but their parents brought them here when they were children. They've gone to our schools. They speak English. They're more American than Mexican or Latino. And we need to fast track them toward citizenship. Most of those people do not want to leave America because this is
They've
their home.
They've never lived anywhere else,
yeah.
So they can remember a lot
and,
of them.
And so they would very much like to be citizens of our country, so
Mike,
we need to expedite
that. Let's tell folks what Peg's book is
Peg
called
Bowden.
Again.
Peg Bowden here is talking about A Land of Hard Edges, serving the front lines of the border. She helps out in the Nogales area. And but I want to hear about before we only got a minute or two left, and it's a little dangerous to introduce a new topic. And Stephen's shaking his head, but we're going to do it anyway. Sophie's Choice. You talked about a Sophie's Choice when it comes to children.
Yes, I think many women I've met have had to leave their children back in Mexico because maybe they have one child in New York or wherever, and they're in the middle, and they have to make a choice. So I go back. Or do I try and cross the desert to see my child who I haven't seen in 5, 6, 8 years? And that reminded me of the movie Sophie's Choice.
And what sort of impact does that have on you?
It's difficult for me to look these people in the eye as an American. I do my best and try and say something positive as best I can to support
being
them.
Being an ad man, I'd like to get in a plug for our sponsors, Democrats of the Red Rocks and Democrats of the Verde Valley. And you can listen to this again on our podcast on vvid.org.
All yes. Our shows for the last almost, 4 years now are available on podcasts on the Internet, and we hope you'll check them out.
Google Democratic Perspective, and if you don't want to do vvid.org, you'll find our podcast somewhere. Some
on
of
iTunes.
Great.
They're on, all available on iTunes, too.
And
that's true.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed being your
it's
guest.
Great
you spoke
here.
This morning at the Democrats of the Red Rocks.
I did, yes.
Right. How'd that go?
It went really, really well. Good crowd, supportive crowd, good dialogue.
And so she got to spread, I think, which is great. This message, which is different than the message that we get from the media, the political message.
Because it is so personal. It's so grounded
exactly.
In her physical experience on the border. And the politics of it grow out of a personal experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes the book as strong as it is.
Did you sell some books this morning?
Sold a bunch.
All right,
thank
there
you.
We go. Well, that's good. So you can borrow for our Sedona audience. You can borrow one of Peg Bowden's books from one of your friends that bought one this morning from the author as she spoke at the breakfast.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.